It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
Believe me when I say we have a difficult time ahead of us. But if we are to be prepared for it, we must first shed our fear of it. I stand here without fear because I remember that I am here not because of the path that lies before me, but because of the path that lies behind me. I remember that for 100 years we have fought these machines. And after a century of war, I remember that which matters most. We are still here! Tonight, let us make them remember. We are not afraid!
Obey, obey, obey when the man comes knocking on your window on your car and says, you be mine. And if you're at a checkpoint with a bunch of guys with guns, he may be right. You know, so we need to talk about this Fourth Amendment thing and how it applies not only as we're traveling around, but in our homes. This is getting bad. I mean, I have been saying for years, I just go, you know, can we hurry up and get to a police state so we can leave? We're there, so I'd like to leave. Thank you very much. And one of the people that it really has been on the front lines of this, we've had him on the air since 03, my good friend and fellow libertarian, Terry Bressy. Now, let me tell you a little bit about Terry. Terry runs a site called CheckpointUSA.com. Org, I was close. CheckpointUSA.org. Now, you go to the Checkpoint USA, this started back in December of 02 when he was accosted by the man because he travels to Kitt Peak, the observatory outside of Tucson, as part of his job. He's scanning the skies, making sure we don't die, okay? I mean, he works at the University of Arizona, goes to Kitt Peak, making sure that, you know, space, we'll get him to give some details on that, but in his job, he has to travel across an Indian reservation down there, Tohono O'odham Reservation, where they were testing out everything. This became very obvious that you think they just all of a sudden explode with scanners at the airports and roadblocks and all this kind. They got to test it, man. Got to have the equipment. Got to have the people. Got to see, you know, where, you know, what kind of I's we got to dot and T's crossing so we can get away with this police state thing. Well, Terry recognized it right away. So what he did, he tells his story here a little bit, but I tell you, we got involved in this thing. We were using his experiences to educate people on the radio. We were doing it on Freedom's Phoenix. Mark Victor got to play attorney. Terry took it all the way to the Ninth Circuit. Now, and he won, they say, you know, oh yeah, we're going to find your favor a little bit over here. But what kind of impact did that have? What have we learned? Well, if you want to know what's going on, you go to checkpointusa.org. All these videos you see from 4409 and Pastor Anderson and people around the country doing all this, you know, can I go, can I go, am I being detained stuff. Where do you think that all started? And I'm sure Terry was influenced by a lot of other people, but he had been doing this and videotaping to the point. A lot of the way that we structure Freedom's Phoenix is because of Terry Bressy's efforts. When you put this stuff up on YouTube, who's complaining? Oh, you got the Union of Border Patrol, we rule you people, going, oh, you got to take this down. Oh, we want to get them fired. Oh, we want to, I mean, every which way they could, they contact us. I said, you know what? We'll just take the files and we'll create it in such a way that we can load video on the Freedom's Phoenix servers and say, hello, come to us. We want to play. And they don't want to play anymore. So this is a lot of how we structured it was for us to be able to have content like Terry's so that it could not be taken down without, you know, I got to get the 45 to my forehead. Show me a court order. Let's go talk this out. Let's get to court, man. Let's rock and roll. And we have attorneys ready to do it. In fact, they were already Terry Bressy attorneys before. So let me introduce you to my good friend and hardcore, before hardcore was popular, activist, Terry Bressy. I got you there, Terry?
Yeah, it's great to be here, Ernie.
You know, I know you're real busy, and so am I. And a lot of times we don't have time to get caught up until we get you on the air. So I'm going to need you to get me caught up here. We got a few minutes before the first break. I want you to take the opportunity to just share with the audience and expand on what I just told them, how you got started on this, what motivated you, and what happened.
Sure thing. I've always been an advocate for privacy and privacy rights and the right to travel. And it was, pretty clear decades ago that those rights were being slowly at times and very quickly at other times being encroached upon by the government, be it local, state, or federal. And, fortunately or unfortunately, depending on your point of view, I have to do a lot of travel for my work, and I travel out on highways and remoter sections of the state. And as you were indicating there, that's where they like to test out a lot of techniques and procedures and processes and equipment to work out all the kinks before they go mainstream in larger community areas. So I've had a front row seat for quite a few years now to a lot of the shenanigans that take place, within 40 or 50 miles of the border in various jurisdictions around southern Arizona here.
Okay, now, so what is your job? I mean, you work, you're at a University of Arizona, you get your University of Arizona pickup, you're driving to Kitt Peak, and you're doing what? I mean, give me a 30-second.
Oh, sure. I'm an engineer for an astronomy research group at the University of Arizona's Lunar and Planetary Lab. We have a couple of telescopes up on Kitt Peak, and we use those telescopes to scan the night sky for asteroids and comets. And of course, we specialize in those objects that may be a potential hazard to the planet at some point in the future that have orbits that could potentially intersect the Earth's orbit. And so we scan the night skies, we collect information on various large rocks in the inner and outer solar systems, and we target them for follow-up observations, and we fine-tune the orbits and put out notices for other professional and amateur astronomers to do their own follow-up routines for these objects.
So if I'm really worried about, something that I'm really going to die, Terry Bressey says so, I take a lot more credence in what he says than, anybody else, know what I mean? So I'm glad you're there. Now, so in your travels, as you go across the desert, how many miles away is Kitt Peak from Tucson?
It's approximately 53, 55 miles.
Okay, so it's not that far. I mean, it's an hour drive, you're going. But as you go there, you got to cross through an Indian reservation where they were testing this all out. So I want the people to understand that early on, right after 9/11, here comes the police state. We've been activists for a long time. We knew what was coming. And you said, oh, I see all the telltale signs here. What was it that you experienced that got you started on your legal process and creating your site?
Yeah, it was December 20th of 2002, late in the afternoon, early evening. I was coming home from a day's work up on Kitt Peak there. And I went around a bend and down and about a mile or so in front of me, the highway was lit up like a Christmas tree there. At first, I was thinking it was, an accident or something else. But as I got closer, I was seeing all sorts of different jurisdictions there. There was the Tohono O'odham Police Department, the U.S. Border Patrol, U.S. Customs, and they were all working the front line. And, and being concerned about these issues, I had been educating myself with regards to the legal issues, how checkpoints must be conducted in order to conform with what the U.S. Supreme Court considers constitutional. And so as I was coming up on it, I knew that it was problematic right away because I was seeing both federal and local jurisdictions working the front line. And if you know anything about checkpoint law, then that's unless there's really something exceptional taking place, then it's probably not being done legitimately. So I was stopped. I asked a couple of questions to the on-scene commander who was with the tribal police. I said, well, what's going on here? He said, well, it's a sobriety checkpoint, and we're, treating everybody the same, asking the same questions, and we want to know if you're drunk.
No, we'll go ahead and finish right there when we come back. This is good. You pull up, and they say, it's sobriety, and we need the U.S. Customs and Border Patrol to, smell your breath.
Right, really?
Exactly. Okay, yeah. Well, that's what we're going to be talking about. We'll pick it up there when we come back here after the break on Declare Your Independence, my good friend Terry Bressey, checkpointusa.org. We'll be right back.
It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
Welcome back to Declare Your Independence. I'm Ernest Hancock here in Phoenix, Arizona. Now down in Tucson, Arizona, where, I don't know, I guess he got to put up with the man even more than we do. And we get our share here, I'll tell you. Terry Bressy from CheckpointUSA.org. I'm trying to convince him to write an article for the digital magazine we've been yakking about. Sierra's putting it together now. We're almost done. Got a bunch of beautiful, and we'll have it done this weekend. Now, what we're going to do is I want to pick it up where we left off. He's driving home from work at Kitt Peak, where he's, does all kinds of scientific stuff. He's going to save the planet, all right? He's coming down around a turn. He's saving it for, truth, justice, and American way. You know, we're doing this for a reason. We want to keep, we want to thrive and survive and keep breathing in and out and not be, robots. So we're coming around the turn. Oh, there's a robot interface down there saying, oh, the slaves get in line. Get in line. What are we getting in line for? Who was there telling you get in line?
Well, we had U.S. Border Patrol, U.S. Customs. This is before the Homeland Security Act, which combined the two, and the Tohono O'odham Police Department.
Now, the Tohono O'odham, see, that's one thing that's interesting, and we could see what was coming. It was how far away from the Mexican border is this stop?
This is over 40 miles north of the Mexican
now,
border.
Now, does this highway run to the border or parallel the border?
It parallels the border. It runs east-west, never intersects the border at any point.
Okay, so this is my point. We're on, we're in southern Arizona. We're 40 mm-hmm. miles away from, the border. I mean, you want to do this border thing, go to the border. So then we're 40 miles away, and is it on a highway that comes from Mexico? No. It goes from Tucson to Kitt Peak through an Indian reservation. So being on an Indian reservation, that in and of itself kind of like, what the heck are they doing here? Is because they had this kind of quasi-jurisdictional pinky permission slip from whatever thing going on, of which you challenged and found out a lot. Now, we'll get to that, but when you were stopped, you pull up, and then what happened?
Well, I pulled up, and I started asking questions, and of course, that always takes law enforcement agents by surprise there, because I had a bunch of questions, and they didn't like people asking them questions. And I asked them, well, what's going on here? And they said it was a sobriety checkpoint. And I said, well, why is there a U.S. Customs agent standing on the front line with you interacting with seized individuals if you're looking for drunk drivers? Because U.S. Customs and Border Patrol don't have any jurisdiction over local sobriety laws. And, that kind of put him back a little bit there. And we went back and forth with regards to the issue. And eventually he walked away from me and turned me over to a detective. The detective said, well, I've been watching you and listening to you, and I can tell that you haven't been drinking because you're talking coherently. I can't smell any alcohol or anything else. But he said, this area is known for smuggling illegal aliens and drugs, and everyone must be identified before we're allowing them through. So the real purpose of the checkpoint comes out, and they were, blatant about it. He blurted it right out. And I said, well, you're not too familiar with the U.S. Supreme Court limitations on legitimate checkpoint operations, because in the year 2000, City of Indianapolis versus Edmond, the court struck down general law enforcement and drug checkpoints as illegal. So what they were doing here is they're trying to masquerade an illegal operation by claiming that it was for sobriety while also doing all of these other things, which is what they really wanted to do. And they even liked me challenging them on this level even less. And before I knew it, there was about 8 or 9 officers and agents surrounding my vehicle, hands on the guns, get out of the car now. Before I knew it, my door was opened on the driver's side by a couple of officers. They reached in, unbuckled my seatbelt, dragged me out of the vehicle, put me down on the asphalt, handcuffed behind my back, dragged me off to the side of the road. And that's where I sat for about 3 hours watching operations for the rest of the night there.
Okay. So how is it that you got away? I mean, you know, did you have to go to jail? Did somebody come pick you up? Did somebody take pity on you? They're just teaching you a lesson. How did this end?
Sure. Well, you know, I think at first they were really expecting to find something illegal, either in my record or in the vehicle or something like that, because they're just not used to people, you know, reacting that way. And when they found nothing in the vehicle, and they, you know, ran my driver's license after they, you know, pulled it out of my pocket and found no outstanding wants or warrants or anything, basically, they were a little bit befuddled. And they wanted me to sign about 45 minutes into it there. They came over and said, well, look, we're going to let you go if you sign this this ticket here. We're going to charge you with disobeying an order from a police officer and I don't know, backing up traffic or something like that. And I said, well, I don't have any intention of signing. So they said, well, we can't transport you away from here because all our men are busy with the checkpoint, so you're going to have to stick around for a while. And in the meantime, they contacted, I gave them the name of my supervisor because I was driving a university vehicle at that time. So it wasn't my vehicle. I felt obliged to make sure the word get out there. And they called my supervisor. The supervisor sent a couple people out to retrieve the vehicle, but that took several hours. So I was out there for about 3 hours overall. And during that time frame, I get to watch a lot of the illegal operations. But when my coworkers came out, the police allowed them to talk to me, and they convinced me that it would be better for me to just go ahead and sign a ticket, and then I could prepare, you know, a defense and get home and do all the other stuff. So I agreed to sign the ticket, then they uncuffed me and they allowed me to go on my way.
Now this, usually when people refuse to sign traffic tickets like this in the past, they go, okay, I witnessed that he refused to sign. The cop signs, gives it to you anyway, and goes on. I mean, that's not a possibility anymore?
Well, you know, I'm not quite sure, but I think in this case, they were charging me with two criminal misdemeanors. Okay, so I think...
So you're either going to jail or you were signing.
Right. I think if it's a civil misdemeanor, then you don't have to sign. They'll just, you know, witness it and that you were served and then let you go on your way. But if it's a criminal misdemeanor, then I think they require you to sign. And if you don't, then they haul you to jail.
All right. Well, they were breaking new ground with you. All right.
Yeah.
'Cause this is all new stuff. Keep in mind, this is December 2002. This is just almost just over a year from 9/11. They already had this plan, man. I tell you what scared me more than anything else, because this happened in December, and I think we had you on in February of 2003. You know, I just started doing radio.
Yeah.
And what happened was the photographs of the equipment that they're using, it was obvious that they were creating an entire industry around this. These, like, cherry picker, it's like a trailer with a cherry picker, what would you call those? Guard tower kind of thing.
Yeah, portable guard towers.
So
yeah.
These portable guard towers, you have a couple of SUVs, Suburbans, a little black and color kind of, you know, got the little cherries on top. They're going down the highway, and all of a sudden, they split off, boom, go to both sides of the road. These come up with people on and say, we got us an instant roadblock. Terry understood exactly what was going on and decided to challenge it and started something for the rest of us. Talk more about it. You need to know this stuff. We come back in just a little bit.
And now, live from the studios of Freedom's Phoenix, Ernest Hancock.
Wow, wow, wow. I feel good. I knew that I would not. I feel good.
Yeah, we feel good here on Declare Your Independence of me, Ernest Hancock, here in Phoenix, Arizona, my good friend Terry Bressy, the man behind CheckpointUSA.org, and I have browbeat him in to make sure he submits something for the magazine, because this is important information. We have Liberty on Tour. Pete Iyer is going to be sharing with us a lot of things that's going on in the magazine also, and they have their own content. 4409 has his own content, and a lot of it is built on what Terry Bressy has supplied them. You know, this is, you know, he was way, way ahead of everybody by years on this. He was very clear in defining what it was they were doing and where the problems were. But as we anticipated then, It's like a clean your crap up manual for the man. Did they? Well, we'll hear about that. So now you've been arrested. You're sitting there for a few hours. You're watching this go on. You're seeing what they're doing. They finally get you to... Whoop, I got a noise thing here. Oh, it's my phone vibrating. And what we're going to do is have you go ahead and continue after you got to leave. Then what? When did you file suit? What happened to the criminal action? Who got involved in it? What was their response?
I was just at that time starting to get involved with local libertarians down here in Tucson. And after I got home, I basically wrote up my account of what had transpired. So it was all fresh in my mind, and I got down all the most important details and that sort of stuff. I started making some phone calls and emails and saying, hey, I fully intend on fighting this thing to the hilts. I want to bring this full bore into the court system. I want to defend myself, get the charges dismissed, and then turn around and file a civil rights lawsuit. Who do I need to contact? And overwhelmingly, the answer that I got back from six or seven different sources was Mark Victor, who at the time and still is a criminal defense attorney up in Phoenix. And so at the earliest opportunity, I got a hold of him, and we set up a meeting, and I went up, and we talked, and he liked the case and decided to take it, and I signed him on to represent me for the criminal charges that had been brought against me.
Okay. So then you're going, all right, we're filing. I'm making an argument. We're making an argument. Now, we're talking December of 2002. I remember us talking in early 03 or before that summer, I think. And then, so how long did it take you to file? I mean, before you even did the civil suit, you were defending against the criminal charges, and you had to go. So kind of run us through that real quick. We'll take extra time. You know, Terry's agreed to stay longer than the first hour if we need to, because I want to get this in the arc. We've had this story before, but there's a lot of the new young people, revolutionaries, have not heard this and don't know that this case went to the Ninth Circuit. And there was a limited win, and we made all kinds of hay on this thing. Mark Victor, then when he would take on other cases like this with Shelton and with the Pastor Anderson and all this, the reason was he already knew. He had already been through this with Terry. You know, not only did he learn something, and we all learned something, and you learned something, it was, you know, it taught a lot to the government, too. So what they can get away with and can't and this, and it just exposes the system for what it is. So walk us through that.
Oh, sure, yeah.
The criminal defense did what?
Well, you know, as you can guess here, you know, the shenanigans at all levels, you know, not only at the checkpoint itself, but within all of the legal proceedings have just been a big, you know, huge boondoggle and shenanigans at every level. So I hired Mark Victor to represent me, and he filed notice with the Justice Court down here in Pima County that I was being represented. And when he contacted the courts, the court didn't know what he was talking about. They hadn't heard of the case. They hadn't seen the charges, nothing. And we were like flabbergasted. You know, this was like a day or two before we were supposed to make an appearance in court on the date that the police had written on the citation. And the court didn't know anything about it. And what we found out was that the tribal police never filed the proper paperwork with the court. I think what they figured, they did a little bit of research. They figured out that they weren't going to get much out of me. I wasn't a smuggler. I was, you know, a highly respected individual researcher at the University of Arizona. You know, they didn't have anything on me, and it was just going to be a lose-lose for them to pursue it. So they decided that they would hope that it would just go away if they just failed to file the paperwork, and I would just be, as happy as pumpkin pie that I didn't have to face charges. Well, that wasn't the case. I was really pissed, and I was fully intending on flushing the issue out. I wanted an answer from the courts whether or not I did something wrong or did they do something wrong, and I was fully intending on getting a verdict one way or the other.
So how do you get them to, you say, no, you see this paper here? File it. Go do something. Make it go where. I mean, what did they have to do?
So Mark requested that the court dismiss the charges against me with prejudice. They dismissed the charges against me, but they did it without prejudice. And this is, you know, once again, for people who don't understand how the court system works in the so-called justice system, it's a Class 3 misdemeanor for a police officer in the state of Arizona not to file a traffic citation with a court once they have issued a traffic citation. A Class 3 misdemeanor. Okay, so the tribal police violated the law by not filing the proper paperwork with the court. And the court also has its own rules that requires the police officers to file the paperwork with them in a timely manner. So they failed all the way around. And to reward them for their violating the law, violating my rights, and violating court procedure, the court only dismissed the charges without prejudice, which gave the police an opportunity to refile the charges against me at a later date. So I talked to Mark and I said, look, Mark, if I'm not going to get satisfaction out of the charges against me, I'm going, you know, I fully intend to file a lawsuit here. So, you know, what's the process for doing that? He said, well, look, just hold your horses here a bit. Let's wait for the statute of limitations to run down. He said, you have 6 months to file a notice of claim with a government agency in the state of Arizona to give them notice that you intend to sue them unless they meet certain requirements. So why don't you wait until that 6 months is just about over with to give the tribal police ample opportunity to refile the charges against you to show that they were doing so in good faith? But if you wait 6 months, then you file the notice of claim, and then after you file the notice of claim against them, if they refile the charges after that, you'll have a strong case that they're just refiling to be malicious and to try to protect their own rear ends from the lawsuit. So that's what I did. Waited 6 months. I filed notices of claims on four of the tribal police officers, including the chief of police, and 2 days later, they refiled the charges against me.
How predictable.
Yeah.
Okay. So they filed the charges. Now you got a criminal charge you can play with. It's almost like taking candy from a baby. Okay. So they filed the charges, and then what fun did you have?
Well, they refiled the charges, and so I hired Mark Victor again to represent me, and he did a couple of telephonic interviews with several of the police officers, got a lot of very good information from them during those interviews, and he also subpoenaed during those interviews copies of checkpoint guidelines, which are required by any agency conducting a checkpoint. He subpoenaed them from the police officers for the pretrial hearing that took place on December 9th of 2003. So we showed up at the Ajo Justice Court on December 9th for this pretrial hearing. And lo and behold, the police officers show up, but they requested an in-chambers conference with the judge when they first showed up. And it turns out that they told the prosecuting attorney, because now you got to think about the jurisdictions here, okay? The tribal police do not have jurisdiction over non-tribal members. So what they did is they convinced the Pima County attorney's office to pursue the charges against me. So it wasn't the tribal police that were pursuing charges. It was the Pima County attorney's office.
Okay, now
so
hold where you're at. We want to make sure we don't miss anything. Make a note, write it down, because this is the beginning of the amplification of the police state, and it always starts where? In Arizona. Why? Because we just have that mentality here. They didn't put that stuff in the water, I guess. We get to say no. No.
Rhodes? It's the Ernest Hancock Show. Where we're going, there aren't any roads.
Independence of me, Ernest Hancock, here in Phoenix, Arizona, from the beautiful studios of Freedoms of the Nest, freedomsphoenix.com, here at the farm. Yeah, I got to do that for Brock, man. He, you know, because I can't. I just got a phone call. I just talked to Pasha Roberts of Silver Circle Movie. They're going to participate in the magazine, too, and have a lot of links, and we'll embed video and do it. Y'all go, oh, it just keeps getting better and better and better. And we're going to be doing some overlap and some stuff at Pork Fest. I'm going to be going to Pork Fest because I can't. We worked it out and kind of whatever the guys will let me sleep in, you know, the spot there, because they're like, Now, we don't want Dad to come, that old fogey Ernie, but, you know, they're going to let me come and hang, and we'll have some fun, and we're going to promote, and I'll participate in some stuff. This movement has been inspired by the foundations of a lot of efforts that came before. And there are a lot of people, I'm sure, that educated and informed Terry Bressey. I mean, you know, he didn't just, have the paper and the book sitting there in the truck with him, you know, and he goes, this seems illegal. I mean, you know, there's some information that he had prior and knew what questions to ask. Now, we'll get to that in a minute, but I want to bring this part up since we're going to be able to spend some extra time with you. There was an incident that you were involved in to kind of demonstrate your character when you were at the University of Arizona. And what happens is now with all this, you know, Facebook, social network, and Twitter and favorite friend picture of everybody I know kind of email crap that the CIA and everybody else has, NSA's got on us now anyway, they can kind of, you know, we know where the troublemakers are. We just go round them all up. Well, one of those guys is definitely Terry. Tell us about the incident that you had where the university was collecting data on the students and you caused a ruckus then. Because that tells people the kind of person that you are that challenges this kind of stuff.
Sure. You know, I try to do, when I challenge authority, I try to do it as responsibly as possible and do my research, do my due diligence, get all my facts together, and then present my case, you know, in a reasonable fashion. And at the University of Arizona, back in the mid to late 1990s, they were carding everybody. Okay, they were issuing new identification cards. When I was at the university, they just had these kind of analog cards, you know, with a basic analog picture and your affiliation and you know the dates that the card is valid for, and a signature from the president of the university. A pretty simple thing. There is no magnetic stripe that contained information on the back. There are no microchips on them. There's no digitized images that were being stored in databases or digitized, you know, signatures or that sort of thing. So it was pretty straightforward and was only being used within the University of Arizona confines so that when you went to the library, you went to another department or whatnot and you needed to access resources, then, you know, it was used the way a proper ID card should be used. But that wasn't enough for them. You know, they were starting to realize that, hey, we got all these vendors around here. They all want access to university personnel and student information, and we want to advertise and get, you know, services and all these other things. We can't do that, you know, with the current arrangement. So we need to recard everybody. We need to create a database of everybody with all this personally identifiable information. And we need to force it down the University of Arizona's throats. So in 96, 97, they were recarding the CAT card is what they were calling it. And what they wanted you to do was you had to go into the CAT card office, stand in front of a camera, digital camera, would take your picture, store it in a database. You'd have to make a digital signature, so they'd store your signature in a database as well. They would issue you the 16-number ISO number, which was which would be used universally for credit cards and bank accounts and long-distance phone services and any number of other ways. And they wanted you to sign up for the service and not give you an option to say no. So that once you went in for your new CAT card and did all these things, they actually had an agreement in place that you had to sign in order to get this mandatory credit card, or not credit card, but it might as well have been one, this mandatory card that relieved the university of any responsibility for the misuse of your information. So you showed up, you had your picture taken, you signed a release form that you were required to do, and all your information was shared with Saguaro Credit Union because the university was making money from Saguaro Credit Union for every student who opened an account using their CAT card. The university would get kickbacks from the credit union. They were working with MCI long distance services. So everyone who made a phone call using their CAT card, which was also serving dual purpose as a long distance phone card, the university was getting a kickback for every phone number that was called. And the university was freely sharing all the information associated with students, faculty, and staff in their database all these other vendors without your knowledge or permission. They were also storing it on a magnetic stripe, so they had your social security number, your date of birth, your sex, your affiliation with the University of Arizona, phone numbers, other contact information on magnetic stripe, and this embedded microchip in the CAT card. So all that information was freely available. Every time you swiped your card through a reader or whatnot, all that information would be downloaded and stored with a third-party, for-profit commercial vendor. And the university was directly profiting from all of these efforts. Well, none of this information was publicly known at the time that they were going through the CAT card recarding. When my time came up to go to the office and be recarded, I decided that I was going to conduct a little experiment. So me and a coworker, we called up MCI and we said, hey, look, we see from the online site here that if when we get a new CAT card, we'll be able to use that CAT card for long distance services. And so how does that happen? And they said, well, all you need to do is provide us with the last four digits of your social security number so that we can verify that you're affiliated with the University of Arizona. So we asked, well, we said, well, geez, we've never done business with you before. If we haven't, then how would you be able to validate the last four digits of our social security number with the full number if we've never done business with you before? And they said, oh, well, the university has already provided us with that information. Okay.
Yep.
So we gathered together all that information. We walked down to where the carding was taking place. We asked to talk to the person in charge of the recarding, and we said, look, you know, we've done this research. It looks like the university, without our knowledge or consent, has shared all sorts of very personal information that can be used by people of ill repute to steal our identities and put us in jeopardy. And, oh, by the way, it looks like in order to get this mandatory card, we have to release you from liability for sharing our information without our consent with third-party commercial vendors.
Which you already did.
Which they already did. And the response, I mean, to this day, I remember the response. There's two responses that really got my goat there. The first one was that, oh, yes, we're aware that there is an issue, but our attorneys are looking into how to make it legal.
We're going to do it.
right, exactly. And, we went on and back and forth with the person in charge there, and you could tell she was getting a little bit irritated with us, you know, that we weren't just going along to get along. And after about 10 minutes, she said, look, only about 10 people out of 20,000 have complained about this so far. And she said, you know, it's the squeaky wheel that gets the grease. So I said,
raised your hand, you said squeak? I mean, what?
I said, okay, thank you very much for your time. And I realized I wasn't going to go anywhere just trying to talk, you know, logic and sense into the person in charge there. So I said, well, she just gave me the information I needed on what I needed to do to fix this problem. She told me that needed to make the wheel squeak. So me and my coworker went back to our offices, and we sat down. We both composed an email with all the information that we had just gleaned, and we sent it out to everybody in our department and another department. Within minutes, I was getting phone calls and email responses of people that were irate and had no idea what the university was doing with their personal information.
Okay, now this is what the lesson we get from this. One, Terry's not the guy you want to be messing with. And the other thing, this has been going on for a long time. You know, when we were the young guys, this was going on. Your real ID is not a card. It's a database. Your face is your ID. They just get a picture of you a long distance, mile away. Boom. They already know everything. And this is how it started. It started way before. Without your consent, without your knowledge. Oh, when we come back, connect all of this into the Fourth Amendment and the roadblocks. You guys stay right there. This is more information I know you need to know. Here and declare your independence. We'll be right back. Uncovering the secrets and exposing the lies. That's what readers of freedomsphoenix.com get every day. Readers of freedomsphoenix.com are constantly provided the information that detail the real news between the lines of propaganda about government policies and the true relationship we all have with coercive governments. Learn the true condition of our economy, innovations and technological breakthroughs in energy, health, computer science, and space travel. Learn the truth well before it's admitted to in the lamestream media, the media that is so last century. Corporate media has evolved into nothing more than distributors of government propaganda, but we now have a fantastic alternative. FreedomsPhoenix.com provides constant news updates on the issues that affect our lives in the most important ways. Our liberty and our property are under constant attack, and FreedomsPhoenix.com provides the understanding behind the propaganda while encouraging the participation of our readers. Join us at FreedomsPhoenix.com. That's Freedoms with an S, Phoenix.com. FreedomsPhoenix.com, where the revolution between the ears has already moved. Tour.